Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs, and you should too. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/expanded. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Going on out there, everybody, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me. I am strip club DJ voice Cam Hell, and join me as always, sitting across the table from me, is Mr. Kyle Big Fizzy Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I'm here in studio. That's right, it's me, Big Fizzy. I'm here enjoying a nice Topo Chico.
I'm rocking the Perrier over here, bro.
It's a sparkling mineral water.
Are there any flavors, or do you have to add your own flavor to Topo Chico?
There actually is one flavor. There's just normal flavor, and then there's like a lime flavor. But it's just a hint.
We've had people share a lot of stuff with us. The crazy reviews of Topo Chico. I ought to pull that up. I think in the outro I'll do some people talking about Topo Chico.
But LaCroix.
I think in the outro we'll talk about that. We'll get into some people
hating
on
LaCroix.
LaCroix.
And I totally understand that not everybody likes it. And they're like, well, this tastes terrible. This tastes like soda pop that's, you know, somebody forgot to do the flavor. Well, I'm like, but you're missing the point. It's not supposed to taste like Coke.
Yeah.
You know, like they're always like, Dr. Pepper, what's the diet Dr. Pepper? Almost tastes the same as diet Dr. Pepper. Well, yeah. I'm like, not really.
Not really.
Almost the same.
It's not meant to be the same. It's meant to make you feel better.
It can't.
If you want a soda, drink a soda.
There's nothing wrong with drinking soda. Right? You just can't drink that all the time.
All day, or day.
Like, I go to 7-Eleven sometimes to get gas or something.
And a hot dog. I know you because you're dirty.
No, I don't eat any food there.
Liar.
I'll swing there to get some gas and maybe some almonds. I like those wasabi and soy sauce flavored almonds.
Boy, do you.
I got like a 2-pound bag over here. It may be $55 for that bag because, I mean, apparently almonds are very expensive to harvest.
They're hard to get.
But, I mean, I see these jokers come out of there with like, I don't know, a 3-liter a mug that holds like 3 liters of cola. And I've never seen one of these guys that looks like they're in really good shape. And I'm just like, my God, man, I like a Coke as much as anybody else. But you can't drink that much.
That much, yeah.
And they're coming in and you can see them refilling it up. So this guy's doing this on the regular.
Where it's been worn. You're like, quit doing it, bro.
I don't know if he fills it up on the way to work and then again on the way home or lunch. But I mean, like, that's too much soda. That's why you need to switch to a little LaCroix or something like that.
And I can't even drink too many of these because I feel like it gasses me up. Like, I feel like
the carbonation.
Like, yeah. I feel like I'm all swole up. Oh, folks. Of course, I am swole up. Look how fat I am. I had posted on Instagram, and everybody went wild, so I'm going to discuss it. We got a bunch of stickers in. We've got a whole pile of stickers in now. We're not sending them out. Sorry for everybody that wanted to get them for free this time. We can't, man. It cost us an arm and a leg to send all those things out because we sent them everywhere. But here's what we're going to do. We're going to be selling them. That's not going to be some crazy prize. We're not going to make you pay $12. Nobody wants to do that. So I don't know what we're going to do with it, but we're getting a e-commerce thing, like we said, set up. And we are going to start having some shirts every now and again, some limited run, like pre-order shirts. We'll only do them for the first, like, however many, you know, and then that'll be it. And then we'll wait a while to do it. So that is coming. So just bear with me. It may take a couple weeks and we get it all worked out. But we're going to start carrying, I guess, the stickers, the shirts, and then that's probably going to be it, more than likely.
Yeah, and with the shirts, it's going to be like, we'll come up with like a design and it'll be like a pre-order. Like you said, there'll be like a time window. Like it'll be open for 2 weeks. And then once it's closed, you can't order any more shirts.
Yeah, that's it.
And we'll do a limited run.
Yeah.
And then we won't do it again for like 6 months. And then the next time we do it, it'll be a different design. So there'll be different ones. And I was thinking of tossing around the ideas as maybe one will be crypto, maybe one will be more UFOs, one will be ancient history. Or
now, we are still going to do the jerseys. So we'll be, when we get ready to get our jerseys done for the softball team, we'll put a pre-order for those out too. So that way, whenever we go to get them made for the team, we'll just throw them all in there in the order together and see what happens.
Yeah, I hope I can play softball. It's been a couple
years since I've done it. You're already on the roster, so you just show up whenever you want to.
Yeah, Big Fizzy. I've seen I've already got sponsorship thrown towards the way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Big Fizzy. He's got his old glove that's got the pocket tied together with a hockey skate lace, and he calls it Black Magic. And he says it's where pop flies go to die. That's what he
always that's an amazing glove, yeah. You know how many pop flies have caught with the thing? A ton.
So, yeah, it's going to be a really, really good time if we get to all play together. But, yeah, so that's it. So what have we got going on today, man? What are you chit-chatting with me about?
Well, I'm nursing a cold right quick because of the last baseball adventure.
Oh,
the
yeah.
last tournament, it was really cold. If you want to hear more about that, you have to be an elite member. You can listen to it on the last show or the upcoming show. Either way, it depends on the release date. Sometimes we record them. I'm not necessarily 100% on when they release, like I told you, or like we've spoken about. We're trying to do a more relaxed show.
Yeah.
We're just far too busy, so it's not as stringent. I don't know when that one's exactly going to drop. But when it does, you'll hear more about the baseball adventures. But I'm going to be talking more about more winged creatures being seen. This is a new sighting on Phantoms and Monsters. Lost Strict has been keeping up with it. And this just happened last Saturday night, April 7th. Of this year. So this just happened.
All right, lay it on me.
And the person says, I'll start with a few months back when it was winter. I live on the Canadian West Coast, Vancouver Island, British Columbia. I think there was a bit of snow on the ground and the sun had just set, so it was not completely dark out yet, but not really light either. My sister and her boyfriend and me and my boyfriend were in our backyard. I think we just went outside briefly to run around in the snow. Since where we live, it's actually a rare occurrence. I know, weird, coming from Canada, right? My sister all of a sudden freezes and says she sees something or someone behind a tree. She then walks over to it, and she sees it disappear. Freaked out, she wanted to go back inside, so we all went in with her. When inside, she told us what she saw was a large, black, winged creature sitting behind a tree looking in our direction. Apparently, it was sitting with its wings down, covering its body, kind of hunched over. Then, when she got closer, she saw it turn the other way, covering its face with its wing so it wasn't facing her anymore. It moved further away behind the tree, and once she was close enough to see it, it was just gone. Now, none of us believed her. We all told her it was probably just a raven, or a heron, or a shadow even, but she was sure she saw something huge, and it was something with wings. We let it go, but she was clearly freaked out. Now, fast forward to this last Saturday. My boyfriend and I, my sister and her boyfriend, the same people as before, were all in my bedroom, which is the master bedroom to the house, and we have these French doors that open up onto the sun deck that looks out into our backyard. We were just about to smoke some weed together when my boyfriend opens the door to the sun deck that looks up past our backyard to see this massive bird leave a branch in a tree. He said, holy sh! That eagle is huge. Or huge.
Huge.
I looked up just in time to see it leave the branch and fly for like 2 seconds before it disappeared behind more trees. But it was bigger than an eagle for sure. It wasn't in a tree in our backyard, but we have this embankment that goes up to these apartments that are next to us. And the tree we saw the thing fly off of was up there, so it wasn't really clear. But we have eagles around us often, and I have never seen one that size. It looked like its wingspan was at least 14 feet. It was completely black. My sister and her boyfriend just missed it, but they saw the tree branch it came off still bouncing up and down from when it jumped off. I said it looked like a human with wings, and my sister freaked out and reminded us all that about the time she saw that thing in the backyard. All of us had forgotten about it until she told us about it again. Now, I actually believe her. My boyfriend said it looked like a human with wings, but he doesn't believe in stuff like that. Plus, on top of this, we had a dog who passed away in January. R.I.P. Juno, I love you. But she would sleep on the sun deck if it was warm enough for her. And often we could hear her growling at something in the backyard and pacing back and forth. It could have been a deer in the backyard, I suppose, or even a raccoon, but my dog was uninterested in deer in her old age, and raccoons used to come on our deck all the time, and we would hear them. But this time, it was different. So, Lon goes on to talk about how he got in contact with this person and asked him a few more questions. And he said he asked the witness if they could provide any further information. And the following was sent. He says it was on Vancouver Island in British Columbia, Canada. The thing was all black. The wings looked like they had feathers. They were longer than any eagle's wings. And it looked like a Mothman gargoyle body type. So, apparently, for whatever reason, people are seeing these flying winged humanoid things. Not just in Chicago, not just in Florida, not in just Illinois, not in just Wisconsin, but now in British Columbia, up in Vancouver Island. I mean, what are people seeing? Is it all the same thing? Or is it multiple? Are we being overrun with Mothman-type beings and we're not even aware of it because they only show themselves at night? I don't know.
I don't either. It's so wild. Is it the fact that maybe it's just large birds and people are misidentifying, and because of this flap, more people are looking up?
It could very well be. I mean, that area, as the person that wrote the story talks about, I mean, eagles are prevalent in that area.
Yeah.
Maybe it was just a misidentification. It just looked larger than it was. I don't know.
Man, it's weird.
But, man, you know, just all the sightings of these winged humanoids, it's getting out of control.
And like I said, we've heard that there is some could be possible shenanigans with the one in Chicago, that somebody has been riding a bunch of fake stuff coming out of there, that it was one person reporting all of it from different emails and different creating all this stuff. But it was from the same IP or something. But you always, you know, that's something else I would put out if I didn't want it to anybody to know it was real.
Well, you know,
if you were trying to cover it up or something, you'd be trying to release more flood it with false information because let's be honest. Think about it this angle. If it's real, what if it's taking people? Like, what if the people that are going missing, I don't know how many there are, but what if there are people that go missing? What if this thing's taking them? It's much like what we talked about with missing 411. The government doesn't want that to get out, because if it gets out, what can they do about it? If this is some crazy interdimensional being that's grabbing folks, the government can't help you.
I know. That's what's terrifying.
Yeah, it's not going to work. Not at all. I've got something here you're going to enjoy from the MUFON website itself that Roger Marsh, our amigo over here, posted about a hovering UFO. And this is the creepiest part. It said it seemed to isolate the witness. Now, this is a California witness at Rancho Cordova, reported watching a disc-shaped object hovering, get ready, 20 feet above the ground, while others in the area seem not to notice. Now, this is from Case, get your pens out, folks, 83576 of the Mutual UFO Network. This is the witness and his fiancée were leaving a restaurant on Folsom Boulevard at Hazel Avenue when the incident began. The witness says that I spotted the object at about 45 degrees from the horizon in the south. The weather was overcast and cloudy with winds from the west at 10 to 15 miles an hour. Now, when I first saw it, I thought it was a helicopter because of the green flashing lights that at first looked like navigational lights. He goes on to say that the object had a dark matte gray or black finish and was silhouetted well against the clouds. Now, it had descended to a level where it was obscured by the parking lot tree and then fully descended to full view across the street. The completely silent object was approximately 60 foot in diameter, saucer-shaped, with three white lights on the west-facing side and a red glow underneath. Says that the object stopped descending and hovered about 20 feet off the ground and was only 180 feet away from the witness. Witness goes on to be quoted saying this, the object showed no signs of visible propulsion, nor did it disturb the vegetation in any way. At this point, my fiancée wanted me to take a picture, so I sent her for my phone in the car. It seems as if the UFO knew she was coming back with a phone because it started moving off as soon as she had it in her hand. Now, Sid quickly noticed this odd part of the situation, said, we found it strange that no one else seemed to notice it, that even though there were people in the parking lot with us and cars passing by. Says, I was completely mesmerized by how smooth it moved and how it was unaffected by the wind. Says, now talking about his fiance, that when she got back to me, I had walked to the corner of Folsom and Hazel so as not to lose sight of it, and it glided away smoothly and onto or into the Aerojet property. Yeah. So it's, and of course it was investigated by their state director, and of course it's closed as an unknown UAV.
But lots of people that were there milling around and stuff, they didn't notice it.
Never noticed
it. So, like we've talked about it before, how certain people, clairvoyants and mediums and things and such, are they're able to see spirits and ghosts, and other people are not. I wonder if the same scenario is possible for UFOs, where certain people, you may have this ability, you're not aware of it, and then one day you see a UFO, no one else saw it because they don't have that same ability. And people with this ability are people that see UFOs. I mean, just like in the stories I read on the last Elite show, the woman said her and her husband, who saw a UFO in Alaska and had some missing time, that her and her husband have seen UFOs many times in their lives. And you run into people quite often who have seen a UFO. They say that they've seen them multiple times. So it's not like it's a one-off event.
Yeah,
for the most part. So I wonder if these people have this ability to see it and others don't. I also wonder, like the guy talked about how it almost like the UFO knew that he's going to get a camera and it was moving off. I wonder if they're able to read, like, you know, what everybody's thoughts are, like an open band radio, like they can, and then they all of a sudden they see a thought come across like, uh-oh, somebody is going to get, let's move.
Or
I don't know.
It's got flashing lights on it. It's man-made. Whatever it is man-made. I mean, an alien doesn't need flashing safety lights.
Well, they don't need safety lights, but maybe they just like safety lights because they think they're cool. I mean, yeah, they have no idea.
True.
You don't really need curb feelers on your car, but people put them on there because they think it looks cool for whatever reason.
But like what you brought up is somebody with the ability. It does almost seem like that. Like we talked, maybe it's physical. Maybe there's something with their eyes or something normally that most people, like we've never seen one. Maybe you and I don't have the ability to see
that's
one.
That's right. And maybe these people that have this ability are the ones that are chosen for abduction.
I mean,
there's nothing showing that when people are abducted by aliens that it's completely random. Maybe there's a selection process that the extraterrestrials use. Like, you're on our wavelength, so you're the one we're going to take.
Yeah.
I have no idea. But
that's good for me because I'm a dummy.
Apparently, I've never had anything.
Yeah. So we're good. Like we're covered.
And I'm happy.
Yeah, I'm not complaining. About that whole thing. Folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, I'm going to be discussing, of course, some wild conspiracy theory, because they're fun, but I'm going to be discussing some crazy conspiracy theories linked with Plum Island. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. Guys, what's going on? All right. It's story time with Uncle Ham. I've plopped down here in my little at-home studio. Going to do some more recording. This is something that I've been wanting to talk about for a while because I actually knew someone who lost a loved one due to this. So this is something I'm going to get into. And like I alluded to before the break, I'm going to be talking about Plum Island. But before I get into that, like we always do, you have to lay out the groundwork. We have to discuss things about how our government's already gotten to us. We got to build up to this conspiracy theory craziness because we all love it. I mean, what's not to love about a conspiracy theory? So we'll start with a few, I guess, we'll build up to where we're going with this whole thing. Because I don't think nowadays it's too hard to sell people on the idea of a conspiracy theory or something crazy going on, the government behind some no good things. I think it seems to be easier and easier. Now, that's not to say that everything that they do is wrong and they is, you know, I guess that's just a an open-ended term. We don't really know who, you know, we just feel like they are the government. You know, they do get a bad rap from time to time, but we do know in the past that there has been some nonsense and some shenanigans that have cost people their lives. And they denied it at the time, and now it's come out. Of course, it's true. One of them is being the fact that in the late 80s, there was a report released called the American Nuclear Guinea Pigs, and it came from the U.S. House Committee on Energy and Commerce. And they were, this report, the American Nuclear Guinea Pigs, the title were Three Decades of Radiation Experiments on U.S. Citizens. Now, what this actually spoke about was what's known as Operation Green Run. And it was a test at a Washington plutonium facility is where this thing all took off. But it didn't happen, of course, in the 80s. This is when it all came out. This is what lies behind this. It took place in 1949. And it details that the managers of this air of this facility decided that they would on purpose now, on purpose, release this cloud of radioactive iodine 131. And it was a massive cloud. We're not talking about a little, like a hot air balloon, you know, a little balloon full of 131. We're talking about a ginormous cloud of it. And they wanted to see how far it would travel in the winds. Let's say downwind, what would it affect? So let's just release it. So they cut loose the iodine 131, and then they cut loose some xenon 133. Now, the story goes that it traveled as far as the California-Oregon border, y'all, and that it infected over 500,000 acres. Yeah. So they talk about curies of radioactive iodine, and they say it was 8,000 curies is what floated away from all this in this big cloud. And I think of like some big creepy, like green mist cloud, like you'd see in Ghostbusters. That's kind of what I think it'd be. But just so you get an idea of what a curie is, back in 79, whenever Three Mile Island had its little meltdown and all the stuff went on, everybody was all freaked out about it. The curies of radioactive iodine that was released from Three Mile Island was only 25. This was 8,000 curies that come out of that cloud. So that tells you what ended up happening. So they, in the paperwork, it also says that the government went on and did a few more tests like that, smaller tests, none quite as big as the one in 49. Oddly enough, in the late 50s, there was a state hospital there, and it housed disabled children, called the Sonoma State Hospital. And they know for a fact there that these disabled children, without their knowing and without consent of any of their families, were actually fed radioactive or irradiated milk. So this goes along with part of this, is they're testing it to see what it's going to do to people. They also know that in the state of Tennessee around this time, that there were pregnant mothers that took a vitamin drink, and they were told that this vitamin drink would be great for them and their children. Turns out it was radioactive iron, and there was 829 women that were involved in that study, and that's what they were given to see what would happen. So you can see where I'm going with this. There's a lot of these things that go through where they gave it to kids. They gave it to women that were pregnant with children. You look at all this. There was also, like we talked about, Operation, there's another one, Operation Plumb Bob. And this took place in the 1950s, 57, I believe, is actually when it took place. And they were testing nuclear explosions in the Southwest here in the States. They were 29. And at this time, there was 18,000 soldiers in the area where there were 58 curies of this radioactive iodine. And it caused upwards of 212,000 cases of thyroid cancer of all the stuff that was tested around there. They became known in the 50s. The people that were in contact with all this became known as the atomic veterans. That was the little quote given to them, or the little name, if you will, given to them. So our government knowingly experimented on its citizens. They just like, let's just see how far we can go. If you go back even further than that, for those of you that aren't familiar with the Tuskegee timeline or the Tuskegee syphilis experiment that took place in 1932, they worked with the Tuskegee Institute, and there they started a study to record natural history of syphilis in hopes of justifying, it says, treatment programs for the black people at this time. This is what they say in this, and they called it the Tuskegee Study of Untreated Syphilis in the Negro Male. This is the way they approach this, is they're like, oh, as long as it's not white people, let's try it on the black people. That was the stance. 1932 isn't that long ago for the government to be so overly racist. It's insane. So, yet again, it involved 600 black men. There were 399 of them with syphilis and 201 who didn't have the disease. So the researchers told them that they were being treated for what was called bad blood. Okay, that's what they said they're treating them for. And that could describe lots of stuff. You know, they kind of lumped it all together. Oh, are you wore out? Are you tired? Do you feel like you have an iron deficiency? Are you anemic? Things like, this is what we're treating you for, is air quotes, bad blood, which sounds like something a 1932 doctor would say. I saw an old meme not long ago talking about that being a doctor in the Wild West or the 1800s must have been great. It's like they said, oh, you've got ghost in your blood, so just go out and drink whiskey and do coke. It'll be fine. That's kind of what this is, oh, you've got, air quotes, bad blood, so we're going to treat you for this. They didn't receive any proper treatment whatsoever. None. To cure anything. That's nothing that they accept. But this is what they did get. They got free medical exams, free meals, and oddly enough, free burial insurance is what they received. So it was supposed to last 6 months. It went on for 40 years. 40 years this took place. So the Associated Press in 1972 picked up this Tuskegee study. People go crazy, and they have the right to be. So they had a panel of members look into this from all different stuff. They found that the men had agreed freely to be examined and treated. However, this is what they did find. There's no evidence that researchers had told them of the study and its real purpose. So they're telling them, we're going to treat you for this, and they just didn't tell you the whole story. So they go to digging deeper and deeper. Then they find out that there was no evidence that they had informed them of the study or its real purpose, and in fact, that they know for now that the men had been misled and lied to and not given everything to provide consent. So everything that they had been told was all a lie to just get them to be test subjects. They were never given adequate treatment. And now look, penicillin was the drug of choice for syphilis in 1947. It was not offered to any of the subjects in this group. So out of all the males, nah, you're good. We're just going to test some other stuff on you. The idea of testing on human beings is something that is crazy to me. But the idea of playing upon one and of course, I don't know why it's crazy to me. I feel like they do it now with our food. I feel like they do a lot of this stuff, like they're testing on us now to find out. So there was a class action lawsuit filed back in 73 for all the participants and their families. There was a $10 million out of court settlement that was reached. The U.S. government promised to give lifetime medical benefits and all this to all the living participants. It goes on to become, they established what's known as the Tuskegee Health Benefit Program. And then, of course, in 1975, the wives, widows, and the children of all these people were actually added to the program, and it started expanding more and more because they realized what they had done it pretty much ruined everybody in that lineage. Like, they know that, I mean, this is something that could have been passed on. We don't know a whole lot, but I say passed on. A wife could have received it not knowing that her husband had it because he didn't know he had it. Things that goes along like this. So there's a bunch of wild stuff that went on, and it carried so far back that the last study participant actually passed away in 2004. And then the last widow that received the benefits from the Tuskegee Health Benefit Program passed away in 2009. And currently there's somewhere like a dozen, maybe a little less, of the offspring that received medical benefits and health benefits that their family was involved in that study. So I tell you all that in a roundabout way, so we already know that it started back then. We know that they've tested on people. This is just scratching the surface. So for those that are screaming at the computer or screaming at their device right now that I'm not covering all of these, I'm not going to dig deep into those right now, but because we already know that this happened. This is stuff you can pull up in the FOIA. You can find this stuff. This is there. But to let you think about this, that in 1955, there was a little thing called Operation Dropkick. Now, this is where it starts getting pretty wild. Now, Operation Dropkick involved mosquitoes that carried the yellow fever. Our military released 330,000 of these mosquitoes from an aircraft over the state of Georgia. Now, this was called Operation Big Buzz. And Operation Dropkick was 600,000 of those mosquitoes more was released over an Air Force base in Florida, and that was in 1956. So 55 and 56, they're cutting out mosquitoes with yellow fever. Now, they say this. They say that, hey, look, in these cases, these mosquitoes didn't have any disease, that they were just test weapons, that they were going to try to use entomology, and they were thinking that they could have the insects do the dirty work for them. So they studied the bug's ability to disperse, where they would all travel, where they would all go, how they would attack, the results of these things, and how they would be on the humans and this. So in 1954, there was a thing called Operation Big Itch, which we talked about. Operation Big Itch dropped 300,000 rat fleas in the western Utah desert. And then the military was trying to test those fleas if they could carry and transmit disease. Now, it's said that during one of these tests, a bug bomb failed to drop and that it actually opened up inside the plane while they were flying. And everybody on board was eaten up with these rat fleas. Now, of course, it'll tell you, oh, yeah, there was, you know, there's nothing going on. It's just they're just fleas. We just want to see how far they go. If there's nothing wrong, if there's no disease in these fleas, and there's no way of, and mind you, folks, this is the 50s, and there's no way of tracking them. Because if you could test a flea or you could test a mosquito, say the mosquito had yellow fever, okay? If it didn't carry yellow fever, how would you know that was the mosquito you released? You have to have something in that mosquito as a primer so you can check to see if that's a mosquito or if that's just an average everyday mosquito. You know, that's just a native mosquito. The same thing with those fleas. In my mind, there has to be something wrong with that flea. What, are you going to spray paint them all pink? You know, it doesn't work like that. You have to have something in a mosquito or in a flea's body in order for them to test it. Because I'm sure that rat fleas, I'm sure they're out there already in the Utah desert. I would guess, but it would make sense. And then how, you know, we all know how little fleas are. How are you going to catch them? How are you going to, unless people start popping up sick? That's, for me, the thing that I keep thinking about. So there were Soviet cities that had been marked as a testing ground where they wanted to release these things. And their idea was if they could grow and produce, the government's objective was 100 million mosquitoes. They wanted to have a military-owned, military-ran insect farm. And they wanted to grow these mosquitoes and raise them with the disease. We're going to say yellow fever because that's the what we were given. Raise them with yellow fever, and then they could take them to these Soviet cities and release them. And there you go. You have 100 million mosquitoes per month, and then you can go and release them in the skies, however they were planning on do it, on your enemy. I mean, then just let nature take its course. That was, it seems like what they wanted to do. Now, there was two other testing programs that went along. We said Operation Dropkick and Operation Mayday. And in 1981, there was more tests that went along and all this other stuff went along. And they were trying to figure out if what they could do as far as, let's say, the cost. Is this going to be cost effective? Now, they didn't declassify all the paperwork, but they declassified some of it without redacting everything. So with Dropkick, like I said, in the paperwork there has a thing called cost per death calculation. They estimated this, that this biological agent that could they believed could achieve a 50% mortality rate on any city that they dropped it in. This was in 1976, was 29 cents. They said that this would take 29 cents. So they were estimating that it would result in roughly 625,000 to 650,000 deaths is what they could do. Well, as crazy as that sounds, in 1990, the United States itself funded a $6.5 million program to research, breed, and drop caterpillars, folks. They were going to drop these caterpillars in the coca fields of Peru to help destroy the fields and the plants that they make cocaine from. And then just here, I say recently, but it's still in the 2000s. 2002, there was efforts at Fort Detrick to focus on finding an insect virus that would affect opium so they could find a way to fight it this way. So what's the best way to save human lives and manpower and all that stuff is you drop caterpillars. You grow them, you breed them, and you and I'm not so sure that that's not, like we say, going on today. If you could change their DNA, you can alter them. I mean, the things that we can do now, you could change this up to where you could have a caterpillar dropped into a coca field. You could have grown like these super mosquitoes, or you could grow things. There's all of this stuff that you could change and alter to turn bugs into weapons and it's no problem. Now, there's actually some paperwork from 1972 that's called the Biological and Toxic Weapons Convention, okay? And in there, they mention insect, what they call insect vectors, in the writings of that. And it's a treaty. But in that treaty, when they're talking about the Biological and Toxic Weapons Convention, where they're talking about this treaty of, you know, you're not wanting to use this stuff on people, nowhere does it say anything in it about insect vectors. So somehow they've worded it around to where, oh, it's no big deal. Now, there is an article in there, and the first article bans this. It bans weapons, equipment, or means of delivery designed to use such agents or toxins for hostile purposes or in armed conflict. So if you read that, you're like, well, okay. But the insect vectors is a part of entomological warfare. They're covered, and it claims that it's all outlawed, of course, because this falls into that area. But it doesn't point to the finger specifically to insect vector. It just throws, you know, that's a broad brush. It bans all weapons, all equipments, and all means of delivery designed to use these toxins or these agents specifically for armed conflict or hostile purposes. So that alone. But where it's not really clear is when they're talking about releasing uninfected animals, like these caterpillars, on crops. So that instantly makes me start thinking about Monsanto. If Monsanto has, you know, people that are trying to rise up against them, and then they somehow release these caterpillars that are only going to attack your crops and not Monsanto's crops because they've been GMO, they've been modified to be resilient to these caterpillars, and they release them. Well, then it doesn't go against the ban. Your crops get decimated, theirs doesn't. They put you out of business. So the idea of releasing these mosquitoes isn't jam up. You can't really do that. Of course, we all know about the rules. The people that ride them usually are the ones that break them or bend them. So it's kind of six of one, half a dozen of the other. Well, that brings us around to what I talked about leading up to this. And that is Plum Island. And the Plum Island I'm going to talk about is its ties to Lyme disease. Now, I have a good friend, and I haven't spoke to him because he's not that good a friend. I haven't spoke to him in a long time, but he and I used to shoot a lot of archery together, years worth of archery. And I haven't seen him in a long time, but when I had first met him, it was only about 6 to 8 months after the passing of his son. His son contracted Lyme disease, and it ended up killing him back in the 90s. This was something that I never even heard of at the time. When I found out about his son, I had never heard of Lyme disease and didn't know what it was. So you start looking more into it, and things start popping up. Now, look, it could be nothing more than, like we say, your conspiracy minds wanting to see and read more into this. And I agree. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of it. But like we've discussed in this show multiple times, is it's the small threads that make you want to start thinking. You start looking at these things. So that's why I bring up Plum Island. For those of you that aren't aware of what Plum Island is, it's in Suffolk County in New York. It's an island, and it's right on the end of Norfolk Coast of Long Island. So it's real close to the coast there. It's like, I think, 3 miles long and like a mile wide. So it's not a huge plot of land. But in 1954, the USDA built on there the Plum Island Animal Disease Center. And that's where they started doing research on animal pathogens. Now, they said they were doing it to help protect the ranchers, the national food supply, help protect farmers. They don't know this. It was something that they were like, okay, we'll be able to fight what they're growing, like we just discussed. We need to, if we're thinking of this, other people are thinking of this, we better have something that studies it all the time. So, of course, because of that and the ideas behind it, well, everything became restricted. Well, anytime you restrict anything, people start talking. So now you can't get access to the island. You can't get access to the facility. You don't know what's going on. Walls are up. Doors are closed. Windows locked. Nobody knows what's going on in there. Well, in the early 70s, there was a group of kids and adults in a town called Lyme, Connecticut, and even in these surrounding areas. And the doctors and people in this area started knowing that they started having some really debilitating health issues that they couldn't put their finger on. They were like, huh. And when I say couldn't, they had chronic fatigue, right? Some people started reporting they had paralysis, severe headaches, skin rashes were popping up. They were going to these hospitals. More and more people were showing up. They couldn't figure out what it was. Swollen joints, swollen knees was a big thing. when it first came up. And as far as I know, it still is, but it was a big thing that they were like, why do these, it's tying together. Like, we don't understand, you know, headaches. Like, you start seeing headaches, you're like, okay, what is it? Allergies? What is it? This? What is it? That? Chronic fatigue. You know, we don't know. Is it your diet? We don't really know. But when you start seeing swollen knees and skin rashes on not one or two, but multiples back to back to back reporting the same thing, you're like, wait a minute. Everybody's not turning their knee. You know, not everybody's been out running. Not everybody's got a strained MCL or ACL. Like, what the hell's going on with this? So they start looking more into it. Well, they can't really figure it out. So nobody diagnoses them. The doctors just leave them. So if they don't diagnose, they don't treat, right? So they just leave it alone. Goes down, goes down. There were two mothers that was involved in this group, and they were from Lyme, Connecticut. And they are the ones that pushed and pushed. They became what's known as patient advocates. So they start doing their own research. They start taking notes of what's wrong with them, their symptoms. They start talking to other people. And instantly they start jumping to, is it in the air or is it in the water? Where is this coming from? There's too much stuff going on. Then they start talking to children that have been affected with this. And why are these children have this arthritic, like, problems? Like, that's when I'm talking about the swollen knees, the joints, the elbows, the ankles, the back, the fingers, the neck. You're like, why is this stuff going on? So what do these moms get to? Of course, like you said, you leave it to a mom. You can let a mom, you get her wound up about her kids. There's no stopping them. Like, hell hath no fury, like a mom on a mission. And that's for real. So they start digging into it. These two women are digging into it. What do they come up with? Everybody that they reached out started talking about, well, I got bit by a tick in this area of Lyme, Connecticut. So I'm like, huh. So then they start reaching out to other scientists. They start going, okay, this is what we found out. We found out this and this. And we know these signs and we know this stuff. And this is the telltale signs of what's known of now is Lyme or Lyme disease. Now, if you talk to some doctors about it or you do any reading about it, it's known as what's called the great imitator because it mirrors things. It mirrors things like fibromyalgia or lupus or even Alzheimer's. There's a lot of stuff that goes with it, along with that chronic fatigue. There's a lot of things that you go with that it has those signs. So it leads you down the wrong path. And I'll give you a list of some of the stuff that we talked about. Mood swings, insomnia, nausea, confusion, restlessness. You know, like you're really, really tired, but you get on your sleep. You can't really rest. You know, it's not good. Headaches that doesn't go away. Of course, chills, dizziness, impaired short-term memory, fever. You can't hardly concentrate. It's hard for all this stuff. And then what does it do? It starts attacking your organs. It goes after your digestive system, the reproductive system, the heart, circulatory, ends up in the nervous system, in the core, like it gets to your brain, things like that. So as it goes more and more undiagnosed, it slowly starts, like in other diseases, taking its hold on them. Well, people, it's something now that you bring up Lyme disease and people talk about freely, but it's still the details of this whole thing is like, oh, well, you get it from a tick. That's all you ever hear. I have had, I can't even tell you how many ticks on me. The time that I've spent in the woods, the time I have spent processing wild game, to have a tick on you, you wake up, it's, I don't mean just like crawling on you being in the woods. I mean like attached. And you have to get them off and all that stuff. And I've often wondered about going and getting checked. I don't know. I mean, yeah, do I have joint pain? Yeah, but I'm also 42 and I've put a lot of mileage on this body. So I don't know if that's what it is. Am I chronically tired? Yeah, but who's not? Who's not tired? You're blowing and going. Everybody's tired. It can be so many different things. So I don't know. You know, it's one of those things. But if you go to the CDC and you start looking into the CDC stuff, in 2015, it was the most commonly reported vector-borne illness in the United States. It was also nationally notifiable disease. It was the sixth most common in that. And they said that it affects what they say is 300,000 people a year in the country of the United States. Yeah. But what's really weird is that when people go out and they attempt to get this attention for this Lyme disease, a lot of doctors will be like, well, it's really rare and you probably have something else wrong with you. So they don't even go through it. So then the person that's dealing with this goes through medical tests after medical tests after medical tests, and they go through different doctors and they try to find all this stuff to try to figure this out. So they chase it down and they chase it down. The doctors aren't helping you. And you got to imagine how much money that's costing already now. You know, people are just shelling out. And like I said, now for the longest time, people and these moms, and you go back into the people involved in it in the 70s, were like, there's something going on here. It's like, is it the government? Like, something's happening. This doesn't just pop up. Now, for all of y'all asking about Plum Island, if you go from the shore to shore, from Plum Island to the continent of the United States, it's 9 miles. If you go to the town of Lyme, Connecticut, from Plum Island, it's 17 miles. If that tells you anything, you don't think a bird couldn't carry it. You don't think people could release it. You don't think it could have hitched a ride on something and got out. And like I said, here's the craziest part. Now, the CDC admits this, and you can go do all the research you want. You'll find this, that 95% of cases of Lyme disease come from just 14 states. The majority, so 95. Now, there's always outliers, like we've talked about, but those people may have visited there. You don't know where you've got it from. We have no idea. And with the things that are shipped, you don't really know. But out of the 95% of cases, 14 states report it. And the majority of those states are located what? Around Plum Island. Now, like we talked about, if you go back in history and you start looking into Plum Island, well, of course, it's involved in biowarfare all the way back to Operation Paperclip. Because, yeah, as crazy as it sounds, some of those Nazi scientists ended up working at Plum Island, too, folks. Of course, we all know about Paperclip and all the way they got him over here. But one of these scientists' name is Dr. Eric Traub. Now, Traub was a lab chief during the war for Nazis Insulreims. Now, that was a secret biological warfare lab on what? An island in the Baltic Sea. Crazy, right? I know. Really, really crazy. And who did Traub work for? Well, Traub's boss and one of his good running buddies was none other than Heinrich Himmler. So we know now what kind of, you know, not good they were up to, the shenanigans these fellas were up to. So what's Traub known for? Well, Traub's known for this, spraying viruses from planes over Russia during the war. He had been involved in Nazi activities in the United States at Camp Siegfried on Long Island, where 30 miles from Plum Island. So he goes through. So there's a lot of stuff. We also know that he was really big into viruses and bacteria. He was really big into that. That's the kind of studies that he liked to do. Now, like I said, you get the idea of this is insane. In the early 50s, the U.S. biowarfare program had a group that was a clandestine germ warfare. So inside the biowarfare, there was germ warfare where they would start doing these trials. Well, during these trials, they go, where are we going to put them? Because they know that they were testing them at Fort Detrick. They also know that they were testing them at Dugway. They're like, we need a safer place to test these. This is what we're going to have to do. What can we do? So they take a page out of the Nazis' books. They're like, hey, let's go put it on an island. That'll be the best place for it. That way nothing ever happens. So they get Traub. They do it, all that stuff. The USDA, they visit Traub's lab, okay, this whole thing. And it's said, now I don't know, but you can find places that you can read that it even claims that Traub worked some for the USDA whenever they were putting Plum Island together. Like, he was the overseer for all this stuff. But in the 1950s, Traub actually was chatting it up with, back and forth, the director of Plum Island, Dr. Shahan. He was the director, or Doc Shahan. And so he's over Plum Island, and he's getting his stuff from his buddy, which turned into be a lead scientist, Dr. Traub. So, here's crazy. Dr. Traub was even, when they dedicated Plum Island and the lab and they built it all and they put it all up, they dedicated it in 1957. And during the dedication ceremony, Dr. Traub was there. Yeah, a Nazi was at the dedication ceremony of Plum Island. So you go through all this stuff. So like, huh, that's pretty cool. You know, this is pretty wild. So they go through there. Well, they know Traub, he showed up. He came back in 57. He came back in 58, hanging out there. So they have a lead scientist there. And this lead scientist's name is Dr. Traum, Jacob Traum. So the USDA was like, huh, what are we going to do here? You know, Traum's going to retire. What are we going to do? I know what we'll do. Call up Traub. Let's get Dr. Eric Traub, the crazy Nazi, in here, and we'll get him to do it. So that was the whole plan. Well, until some attorneys get involved and they go to looking into war crimes and all this stuff. And you know, but this wasn't until much later where they start looking up and they find out all the stuff that Traub was involved in. things start going deep. Things start getting really, really wild. In fact, there was a fella named John Loftus, and he was hired by the Office of Special Investigations, a unit that was set up by the Justice Department. And his job was to look into what we're talking about, Nazi war crimes. And because of that, he's given extreme top secret clearance because of the job he has. So he's going to dig into this stuff. So he starts going in and finding out. So he finds out of all these scientists that come over here, what they were doing, the whole thing. And then he digs up something that's really interesting. And this will really get you going. He dug up some information on Traub. And he said the really strange thing about Traub is he had been experimenting with dropping poisonous ticks from planes to spread rare diseases. So they're like, wait a second. And in that part, it's the, I don't know, it gets crazy. There's an attorney named Michael Carroll, and Michael Carroll wrote a book called Lab 257. And if you're really interested in that, you should look into that. You should read all that stuff, because Carroll digs in deep, and he actually has a source that starts talking to him. And this source, he claims there was some other stuff before this, but they claim that these poison ticks were on Plum Island on an artillery range in the 1950s, that it was actually, they dropped them over, I guess, Plum Island to see if they would land, where they would go, and all this. So Carroll in his book talks about that he has a source that worked on Plum Island in the 50s. And it is, the source tells him that these workers would on purpose now release ticks outdoors on the island in 1951. And then it was actually called Fort Terry. And then it goes through. And he said, well, who were these people that were releasing it? And his main source said, well, it was that Nazi scientist that did it. And everybody's like, wait, what? So that's where they start digging. So Carroll goes on to say that he actually got in a box of USDA files from the 1950s from the National Archives, and he starts going through them. And in there, he finds three folders. In those folders, two of them in that box was labeled tick research, and one of them had the label on the folder that said E dot or period Traub. So all three we knew. He claims that when he got into them and opened them all up, all three were empty. There was nothing in those folders. Now, here's something even wilder than this, folks. There was an article written in the Journal of Degenerative Diseases. There's a person named Marjorie Titan and reported this, that 60% of chronic Lyme patients are actually co-infected with several strains of mycoplasma, the most common one being Mycoplasma fermentans. And that is actually something that is patented by the U.S. Army and the Army pathologist Dr. Lowe, a pathogenic mycoplasm. And they patented that in September 7th of 1993 when the patent was issued. So you jump to that. Now, that tells me right there that that's not to say that it was built in 93. That's just when they patented it. Who knows how long they've been testing all this stuff. So, according to Carroll, the fellow that wrote Lab 257, that people had been trying to decontaminate all of this old lab, all this stuff, the whole thing, nothing ever happened. So they build this new building, and it's been called Lab 101. And the USDA and the DHS, and they ran Plum Island, USDA was kind of over all this stuff. So what do they decide they're going to do now, right? Things are falling apart. It's old. You know, we're talking about it's built back in the 50s. What are you going to do now? Oh, we got an idea. We're going to move it up near Manhattan, Kansas, right in the middle of the United States. And for those of you that don't know this, it's like one of the largest areas that where they breed hogs and bovine, a lot of cattle breeding, a lot of animals up there. Okay. Now you're going to move something that tests diseases on these type of animals, but now you're going to move that thing right beside them. Sounds like a great idea to me. I don't know about y'all. Sounds amazing to me. So that's where Plum Island has been moved to, in case you're wondering. If you live out and around Manhattan, Kansas, you might want to consider looking into that. Look around there and go, oh, so that's where they're testing all this wild stuff. Now, here's something that's really interesting, in my opinion, too, because I never even thought this would even be a thing. Apparently, Canada has been dealing with some Lyme disease stuff here recently, too, and they say that it's from the migratory birds in that area. I wish y'all could see my hands. I'm pointing behind me. I'm pointing all around me. They say it's from the migratory birds that get these ticks on them.
which makes sense. You know, I'm sure ducks and crane and geese and everything else get ticks. And they believe that when they come, when it gets wintertime, all the animals migrate south, they get these ticks on them. And then when they come back home, they bring them with them, and that's how they transfer. That's a transfer that you would probably never even consider could be a possibility, because it's just wild that that's happened. But in September of 2009, there was an oversight and investigations hearing, and it was for federal oversight of high contaminant bio laboratories. And this was brought up before the Committee on Energy and Commerce. Okay, now they held this just, I think it was a week or so after the House had a vote, and that's when they voted to move Plum Island to Kansas. And there's a congressman named Michael Burgess, and Michael had this to say in 2009. He said this: the language of the resolution, proudly touting that 45% of the fed cattle in the United States and 40% of the hogs produced in this country are in Kansas. Now, considering that food and mouth disease, which is the primary research being done at Plum Island, is a disease which can spread with devastating swiftness from humans to cattle and hogs, shouldn't we have done our O and I hearing on the scientific evaluations being done at DHS before we voted on a resolution saying that Kansas was the best pick or the best choice? Now, that sounds like a guy that's looking long term. He already knows. I mean, you work for the government. You know, the bar is set real low. You just show up to work, you're getting paid. We already know that. So what happens if somebody lets something go? What happens if something gets loose? Well, I'll tell you what happens. Something really, really horrible was what happens. Now, if you go to the CDC's website, what they talk about today is that Lyme disease is one of the fastest growing vector-borne infections. Like I told you, they estimate it to be over 325,000 new cases of Lyme each year in the U.S. Now, they also say that it is primarily an East Coast phenomenon in the beginning, but now it's been reported in all states except Hawaii, and that they're using diagnostic tools, but that some are still unreliable, and that they know no definitive cure for those with late-stage Lyme. Now, the CDC goes on to say that there's a Bay Area Lyme Foundation, and that they're determined to drive new research, that they will hope that Lyme disease will be easy to diagnose and easy to cure. Now, they will tell you this, and I thought this odd, so I don't know, but I thought it was sure as funny with the propaganda. They claim, of course, that Lyme disease has been around for thousands of years, and that, in fact, there was a recent autopsy done on a 5,300-year-old mummy, and that indicated the presence of bacteria which causes Lyme disease. Now, I don't know about you, but the presence of bacteria which causes Lyme and actual Lyme could be two completely different things. You may have the presence of something in your body that could cause cancer, but you may not have cancer. So there's the difference. The wording is funny that you would read that and go, oh, well, it's been around for 5,300 years. The government didn't make it. Or they're just slowly changing the words a little bit. Kind of like when you go in and you everybody watches these cop shows and these police. So you'd be surprised during the questioning how they can get you to trip up. It's just a play on word. They also talk about Alfred Buchwald. Now, he was a German physician, and he was the first they know of to describe what's known as a chronic skin rash and migraines. Oh, and they say of what is now known to be Lyme disease more than 130 years ago. Yeah. Or it could have been somebody that had a real bad case of poison ivy and a headache. Could have been that too. Now, they say Lyme disease was only recognized in the United States in the 1960s and 70s. And the bacteria that causes it wasn't officially classified until 1981. But if you go online and you do some digging, there is a website, and it's sites.newpaltz, the word new and PALTZ.edu, and it's called Tick Talk New Paltz, and it was written by Smiranda Dimitru, and it says Lyme disease on Plum Island, fringe conspiracy theory or government cover up. And I'm going to read you some of the stuff that she's written, because this is a really interesting article, and I want you to hear this. It says, as an animal disease center, Plum Island has been the focus of many dark government conspiracies, from top secret biological weapon experimentation during the Cold War to the working ground for Nazi scientists recruited after World War II. Perhaps scientific experimentation mixed with government classification is just a hotbed for saucy conspiracies, or maybe there's more to Plum Island than we suspect. And I like where she goes with this. A more recent theory is that Lyme disease escaped from Plum Island, which may be the most plausible conspiracy theory yet. The theory went mainstream in 2004 when Michael C. Carroll's book, Lab 257, The Disturbing Story of the Government's Secret Plum Island Germ Laboratory. And she goes on to talk about how it's where it's located in New York, when it was built, when it came up, the whole thing, how it was run by the Department of Agriculture, the stuff that we've covered. She goes in depth into that, and I really enjoy that. But there's something interesting here. There is an interview. I say an interview. There is at least a small interview from a person that is the chief strategy officer for a Hudson Valley policy-oriented think tank. And now the person's name in the article is April Ferguson. But if you scroll to the very bottom, it says that April Ferguson's name has been changed at her request. So April Ferguson had this to think. This policy-oriented think tank says this, that I don't know if Lyme came from Plum Island. But it's weird that no one wants to talk about it. Doctors are scared to treat and diagnose it, and the government doesn't talk about it. Writes out again here that Ferguson started considering a link between Lyme disease and Plum Island after she saw a press release describing how the Centers for Disease Control were closing a Texas A&M University biodefense lab due to outbreaks of Brucella and Coxiella burnati. Now, Brucella, I know for a fact, is tick-borne. And the reason I know for a fact is because, and y'all probably remember this, my son had to go through a series of treatments for Brucella. Now, he never showed positive of it, but he likes the raw milk. And, of course, it was passed from ticks to the cows and such forth along that way, which really hit because it's one of those things it studies. But goes on, it said, Ferguson was led to wonder about Plum Island, that both the lab at Plum Island and the one at Texas A&M are biosafety level 3 labs and study similar infectious diseases such as foot and mouth disease, alien influenza, and Rift Valley fever. Says Ferguson represents Lyme patients pro bono as an attorney, and that she considers the government's attitude towards Lyme very strange. Says the number of cases jumped tenfold in 1 year, and that insurance companies don't cover antibiotics for Lyme, even though one can easily get antibiotics for any other condition. She says this, and here's the quote, Lyme disease is taboo, and I don't understand why. Now, Jennifer Reed, who runs a Lyme disease support group in Ridgefield, Connecticut, said the connection between Lyme disease and Plum Island is an interesting story. Says it doesn't come up during her meetings, though. She says this, that people are focused on getting better. They're not looking for someone to blame. Now, Reed, she goes on and says here that she blames climate change and deforestation for the influx of Lyme into suburban communities, including that there of Lyme, Connecticut. But it's interesting. It says that Reed said individuals may turn to conspiracy theories such as the one about Lyme disease in Plum Island when they're frustrated. Now, she says this, it's very hard for people to understand why we haven't made more progress. They want something to make sense. They don't understand why it's Lyme disease. It's, well, she's talking about the Lyme disease, is not taken more seriously and given more attention. And I agree. Why is this not something, if there's that many people that are popping up, almost 330,000 people on average a year, and it continues to grow, more people aren't talking about it. Why is there not something you can put in your yard? There's stuff you can put in your yard for ants, for stickers. There's all the, why is there not something coming out that is specifically designed to attack these ticks with Lyme disease? Why is that not a thing? Why are we not trying to kill more ticks? Why is that not something the government's like, hey, let's invent a tick that will kill the breeding of this other tick. Let's breed this out of existence. Why are we not doing that? So like I said before, folks, I don't know if it's real. I don't know if any of these conspiracy theories are real based on Plum Island. We do know for a fact that the Tuskegee experiment was real. We do know for a fact that they released a giant cloud of nuclear iodine. 131, we know for a fact is that. Is this something now that in another 60 years after the people that were affected originally or whatnot that were involved, is this going to come out in some sort of thing? And we're going to find out more that it was a real thing? Because I think if anything, history shows that these conspiracy theories that people hang their hat on at the time turn out to be real more often than not. So it's something to definitely think about. And I hope none of you listening to this are affected with Lyme. I hope none of your loved ones, none of your friends, none of your families, no stranger you bump into is affected with it. And if it is, I'm extremely sorry, because this is something that is terrible. And if you do have an issue with it and you have had some strange dealings with it and you're going through it now, please send us an email. I would like to know how you were treated to see if it really is that way. Personally, like I said, I don't know anybody that's dealt with it. But then again, I'm not near the hot spot. So I would just like to know personally to see how this goes. So let's take a quick break. And when we get back, we'll wrap this puppy up. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. Back, and I hope that you really, really enjoyed that. It's one of those things, like I said, it always makes you think. Knowing now what we know about the experiments that the government has done on us in the past, and that it's freely done, for years before it ever gets brought into the light, makes you wonder if Plum Island wasn't, just a test on its own people, that that's the way it is. Because if you look, folks, and you can pull up a map that will show you the highest concentrated areas, like I discussed on here, of Lyme disease. And it's all right there close to Plum Island. So like we said, it's moved now. The lab is moved to Kansas, Manhattan, Kansas. So I think it's something that we should all keep an eye on. Start watching if anything goes on up around Manhattan, Kansas in the next few years, like I said, because there may be some more, nonsense that takes place because of all that. But I hope nobody's got it. Like I said, if you do, or if you've dealt with it, or you've had some strange things because a family member's dealt with it and it feels like you've been ignored, or, you can tell there's something going on, please shoot us an email, because I would really like to know.
Yeah. Also, if you know some like homeopathic remedies for people that suffer from Lyme disease, yeah, that would be interesting to know.
That's probably one of the things that I'm going to cover and let people know, is that conspiracy to the homeopathic doctor deaths. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
Okay, it's like the natural doctors and the stuff that they've been curing things and the things that they've been working on, and all the deaths surrounding it of really odd things that have happened to those people.
Well, I mean, it's not surprising. If you ignore modern medicine and choose to go homeopathic, it may not work out as well for you.
Yeah, but I don't think it's natural causes.
You know what I'm saying? Like, if you're homeopathically treating like psoriasis or something, that's not a big deal. But yeah, like, you know people that have been like diagnosed with like cancer, and they're like, nah, I'm going to try to do it at home holistically. I'm like, well, yeah, you can, but you're really gambling.
Yeah, you can. I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, there are homeopathic remedies that have worked. And holistic. It's holistic doctors is what it is that have been. I mean, and there are those that work. I mean, they talk about cannabis and all the stuff that it treats.
Yeah,
that's all CBD natural. You start like messing that around with stuff like that, you get into the government's pocket, that's whenever there's a problem.
Yeah, back to Plum Island real quick. I kind of think that that's probably what was going on, is they were trying to manufacture, some kind of disease for military purposes.
Oh, that's what that's something. The whole thing, yeah.
Yeah, and it just kind of got out of hand.
Got away.
Once Mother Nature gets a hold of it and gets infected in ticks and things, you can't stop it.
No.
But it does seem like it's not as prolific as it once was. Like, I remember being a hunter in, like, the early 90s and them really warning you to check yourself for ticks every time you got back from the woods. And I was really worried about it. And I met a few people that had Lyme mm-hmm. disease, but to me, it doesn't seem as bad as it was.
It's not here. It is up there.
It is up there.
Yeah, it is up there. Over 300,000 a year are diagnosed.
Oh, man.
That's just what's diagnosed. Think about the ones that they talk about that go undiagnosed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still bumping along. Of course, you overall, but still, it's one of those things that, it's still there. We just don't have it as much down here.
Yeah.
And I don't know why. I mean, yeah, there's cases,
but I still don't know why it's not spread. It stays in that area. So it makes you wonder how far they can, which is, if so, it's a good study. What they're finding out is a really good study. It's working out.
Yeah, well, if you, in case you've been unless you've been living under a rock, I should say, you might not be aware that it looks like Conor McGregor's got himself in a lot of trouble.
A bit of a pickle, if you will.
I know this isn't an MMA show, but man, what has he done? I mean, and there's one thing to promote a fight. I get that. It's about making money. I totally get that. Mm-hmm. But it's awfully self-centered when you go on a rampage and actually hurt innocent people.
And you pull them, get them pulled from the card due to shattered glass in people's eyes.
Yeah.
Cuts, that's just where,
a little bit overboard. You know, and I was a big Conor fan, but now I have to question that.
I'm really curious to see where it's going to go with his career from there. I mean, who knows? I mean, he is a cash cow for the UFC. But also, too, you're like, dude, you cannot act like this.
In the up and down, I mean, a week or so ago, I posted a Twitter, survey, a poll. Who do you think's going to win, Khabib or Ferguson? And, of course, when that all went down, we had three different opponents show up between then. So that the survey was meaningless at that
point. Null and void at that point.
But a very good fight. My hat's off to Ally Quinta.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Khabib did beat him, but he didn't do a fantastic job, I don't believe. I believe after the third round, he kind of faded.
Yeah. It was, you know what, you learned a lot watching that fight. It was really good. And also, too, one of my faves, and I've watched her fight for a good bit, is Rose Namajunas. And so she did a great job, again, defending the title that she took from Joanna. She defended it and kept it. So
yeah, very scrappy bunch of girl. I mean, she's got a lot of fight in her for such a small little thing. What she looks like, she weighs like 115.
Yeah, I think that's what she fights at. Whew. Or something like that. She's tiny.
But
yeah.
Ferocious.
And the way she was throwing those punches, I don't want no part of that. Imagine that little guy just lighting you up with some 1-2s, then going to the body. And my head's big, dude. You can't miss it. So she'd be lighting me up.
I know that you've been back in the jiu-jitsu gym recently.
Yeah,
How's that new gi working
dude,
out?
Dude, it's awful nice. I'm a big fan. Yeah, I've been in there getting choked like normal. I had to trim my beard a little bit because they were pulling it out. So, yeah, it's been fun. We had a good time. We've got a good bunch of guys. The school's really grown. There's probably 45 or 50 of us in there. So yeah, it's a good bunch of guys right now. It's a whole, everybody seems to have fun. It's real light. I mean, it's like anything else. It there's rises and falls, but this is a good bunch of dudes that are really, they care about one another. And you can tell this the way they tease each other, the way nobody gets a little out of control. I mean, you look after each other.
Well, it's a fantastic sport. Anybody looking to get into exercise, and there's nothing better than jiu-jitsu. You can do it and not get hurt.
Yeah. I'm sore, but I'm not hurt.
Well, yeah, but you're not really.
But I'm
you're
old,
not injured. You're not going to get CTE or anything unless you just go hard.
Yeah, unless I fall down. That's why I play on the bottom a whole lot because I'm lazy.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that when it comes to training in jiu-jitsu, like lots of guys when they start, or gals, they don't want to roll with any black belts. They don't want to roll with white belts. It's the exact opposite. Sounds funny, but you're much more likely to get injured by a white belt because they don't know what they're doing.
Oh, yeah, all day. Yeah, day. Yeah, the higher ranked belts. Folks, I wasn't going to bring it all up, but I decided we've discussed it and all that stuff. This weekend, I will be in Arkansas. So if you're going to the Ozark Mountain UFO Conference, KGRA is going to be there. Dolan will be there. Hobo will be there. All that stuff. So I will be there. So you can come up and say hi. We'll be kicking around, or I will be kicking around. Or Kyle is going to have to be. He's bucking for that Dad of the Year trophy when Father's Day comes up. And I keep telling him all he's going to get is tools to do more work with. So he's not going to get anything fun, but he's bucking for Dad of the Year.
Yeah,
going to all of those baseball tournaments.
Let me tell you, not just the baseball tournament, but Monday, the 15th, 16th, and 17th, I'm chaperoning a camp where I'll be keeping in my lead 10 to 12 fifth graders in a cabin. We're going camping for a school function.
Woo!
And that does not sound like fun.
Look at you, Dad of the Year.
There's no alcohol allowed, no tobacco products. So it's going to be long and strenuous.
Yeah, that's going to be not a good
thing. And because of that, the Monday show may be delayed a couple days. I'm not real sure. I'm going to try to get one recorded before then release, but no promises. If you don't see it till later that week, like Thursday, that's why.
Because
I literally have like a 5 or 6 day period coming up where like I have baseball, then camp.
I would like to, we may need to wait till after camp because I would like to hear the stories of what you went through at that camp with all those kids.
Well, I've already prepared a few stories because, you know, the boys, they tell all their buddies about their dad and the fantastic storyteller and the creepy stuff.
You kind of hurt your arm there patting yourself on the back.
I'm fantastic to fifth graders. I'm not talking about adults. To fifth graders, I can blow enough smoke to where they think it's really
awesome. They think you're the cool dad
so I'm
for now.
Yeah, so I'm already assembling a couple creepy stories to tell around the campfire.
Ooh.
I'm going to see if I can scare a few of them where they can't go to sleep.
Oh, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
If you go deep like the Black Eyed Kids or you really get into stuff, yeah, it's going to.
Oh, I'll curtail it to fit where we're staying.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'll come up with a couple legends in and around because it's out at Possum Kingdom Lake.
Perfect. Perfect. So, I can't wait. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that. And I'm not. I mean, I'm looking forward to the enjoyment. I'm sure I'll have fun. It's one of those days I was talking to Cam off air. If you have your wife like talking to doing something, you're like dreading it. Like, man, I don't want to do that. And then you go do it and you're like, hey, I was wrong. Yeah. I had a good time. I'm glad I did it. I'm hoping it's going to be one of those deals.
But you're not holding your breath.
Not holding my breath. Well, I know some of the events that we're going to be doing is archery is one of them. So that's going to be fun trying to instruct a bunch of fifth graders on the, you know, the world of archery. I think that'll be very entertaining.
I'm going to try. Like I said before, I'm going to try to get Stanton Friedman on the show.
Yeah, that's cool.
Because he's going to be there at the UFO conference. So I'm going to try to chit-chat with Stanton and try to get him to come on.
I know Nick Redfern's going to be there.
Oh, yeah.
Linda Moulton Howe, Richard Dolan.
Oh, yeah.
Several other speakers. I know that the last time we went, we met quite a bit of fans there. Took a lot of pictures.
It was so much fun.
It was a really fun time. If you're in the area, what is it? Eureka Springs, Arkansas.
Eureka Springs, yep.
Yeah, you should get up there. It's pretty
It'll be fun.
Before we get out of here, let's thank our sponsors, ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. If you want that discount, just go to ZipRecruiter.com/expanded. Cam, you got any movies that you've seen recently?
Nothing, man. Nothing.
I watched the HBO documentary. Well, it's not a documentary. It's a docu-movie with Al Pacino where he portrays Joe Paterno.
Oh, yeah.
And they do the whole Penn State scandal. Now,
how was it?
It was pretty good. Pretty insightful. Just as my worst suspicions confirmed, it looked like Joe Pa was kind of aware of the situation, or at least didn't do his due diligence to back it up. Now, I understand you can say, well, he was just focused on football only, but you can't do that, especially when children are involved. But it's a pretty good show. If you have HBO, you might want to go check that out. Joe Paterno was kind of a big thing in my life because my parents, you know, if you're a fan of the show, you know that they're all from New Jersey. Mm-hmm. My father actually went to Penn State University, so I was a big Nittany Lions fan as a kid growing up. But
now you're a big fan of him because of the wrestling program.
Oh, yeah. Chael Sonnen.
Beast.
Speaking of that, Ed Ruth. We just watched him fight in Bellator just the other day.
Such a beast.
Beast mode when it comes to wrestling.
Yeah.
Right. What else do you have planned? Anything special?
Man, well, it's my anniversary up there. So when we get to Arkansas that Friday, will be Friday the 13th is my anniversary.
How many years have you been married now?
23.
Is there any words of advice to those newlyweds out there? If you're taking advice from Cam Hale.
Yeah, first of all, if you're taking advice from me, you're probably already one foot on the banana peel, the other one out the door. I would probably say communication. I talk to my wife about everything. It doesn't matter. I don't care if it makes her mad.
And that's most of the time.
Most of the time, yeah. I don't care if it makes her mad. You get to the age where fighting doesn't matter anymore, so it's just one of those deals that it's really is your best friend, and as long as you laugh and just communicate, that's the one thing my kids always say is there's always laughter in my house. Just like when we come over here. If we're not laughing, there's a really big problem. And Kyle and I have been laughing since the sixth grade. So it's just the way it works. So that's just the whole thing. Communicate and just make it fun.
Yeah, and as long as it's fun, I'm going to continue to do it. If you want to help us out, don't forget you can always write us a review on iTunes. That always helps out. And also don't forget about Expanded Perspectives Elite. You can sign up by going to the website, expandedperspectives.com. Clicking on the Elite tab, signing up is $5 a month. You'll get access to the entire back catalog as well as an episode every week. For Pretty Lights, Inner Tradition Books, New Page Books, Llewellyn Books, and Ancient American Magazine, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.